For most of us, the routine of buying clothing is pretty predictable. Go in, grab a few items off the rack, head for the dressing room, and see what fits. But if you can afford a better class of clothing, you might be able to afford the whole experience offered by a personal shopper. That's a service offered at the high-end New York store Bergdorf Goodman through its Solutions Department. Today's guest is the creator of the department, though she has never liked the name. Betty Halbreich is approaching 40 years at Bergdorf Goodman, and she gives us a look back at her work and the life leading up to it in her book, I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. And the weather sounds very good out there.
It's very, very pleasant, I must say.
Well, I'm looking out of the window facing the park, Central Park, with the Plaza Hotel on the left and a sky that is reminds me of 9/11. I was just saying it to someone. It is so blue, and there isn't a cloud in the sky. So we're having some beautiful weather as well.
That's great, but you know, it's an interesting memory you have there that 9/11 was such a beautiful day.
Well, it certainly was. This is exactly what the sky looked like. It's funny the memories you keep.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're going to ask me about some of those memories I have in this head of mine.
Indeed. Starting off with the very use of the term personal shopper, you don't like that, apparently.
No, I don't know. I don't like any sort of name sticking. I don't like to be called a personal shopper. I am a clerk. I always said I'm a clerk. I'm a shop girl. I've been here almost 38 years. I've been called a lot of names, Jeffrey, to my face and behind my back. Personal shopping is sort of an old, used-up name. I'm just a human being with a lovely office, and I think I've become a clothes therapist in my old age. A lot of people don't even come to buy. They come to consult. It's fine. It breaks up the monotony of selling.
It is. It does sound like people who go to their bartenders or
exactly.
Or
hairdressers.
Hairdressers, yes, exactly.
That's exactly what I seem to be doing. I pontificate a great deal.
Well, you do this and you like it and you do it well, apparently. But you're realistic too. I mean, you know, as you point out, it sounds like it's just clothing to you.
It becomes, well, it's like working in a candy shop. How much can you eat? You know, those marshmallows look very good, chocolate covered. And then after a while, you can't look at them. Clothing becomes the same way. I mean, we have a movable feast here. We have seasons. But it becomes rather rote. And when I wrote this book, it was a grand catharsis, Jeffrey, to tell you the truth. I really wanted to. There are a lot of women like me. I'm fortunate. I'm still working. And that's by choice. And, of course, I do have a boss upstairs that once in a while wonders what I'm doing. But I could be looking with my face looking out of the window into nowhere. And that frightens me beyond anything. So there are so many women. I get so many letters all year round about, oh, I renewed my faith. I'm in a nursing home. It's nice to give back, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, they're you renewed their faith, what, in people working a long time or in putting clothing on well or all the above?
Well, there's more to it because many of these people I've known for many, many years. I've been here long enough that I now take care of grandchildren, I take care of the mother-in-laws, the daughter-in-law, the whole family. And then you pick up new people along the way. Some of it is curiosity. You know, what is she doing? How is she still there? Is she walking? Is she on a walker? I mean, you know, I'm 86 years old, for goodness sakes. So I think that's a phenomenon to a lot of people. I guess when I look in the mirror in the morning, I say to myself, yeah, you really are a phenomenon. You're going to go back there and do another day and another week. But it's extremely rewarding. Being with people all day is rewarding.
It really is, it sounds like. Although it sounds like you're more there for the personal contact than for, and again, for the clothing. And in fact, you write in the book about having some issues with the clothing prices.
I'm very conservative. I'm Midwestern. I wasn't so conservative when I lived in Chicago. My father was taking care of me. But I am conservative because if you see these people as often as I do, you can't keep just grinding them out with clothes are very expensive today. Whether it's Bergdorf Goodman or it's any shop in America, clothes are very expensive. When I see the price of shoes alone, my God, you walk in mud, you walk through rain, snow, they're a fortune. So I don't like to capture my group and just keep selling them for price reasons. That's why I've never been a commission lady, which shocks people.
And not great with numbers either, from the sounds of it.
Oh, dear God, I can't add. I can't add, subtract, or divide. I've never wanted to. Figures are very intimidating to me. I'm visual, but I can't deal with figures. I can't deal with machinery. I will explain to you. I do not drive. I don't use a cell phone. I don't email. I don't use a computer. I mean, a lot of people that are listening to this are going to say, this is some stupid woman. Best she'd come up into the world. But you know something? I think I see my world better than some of all the people who are constantly on their cell phone. They never look up.
They don't very often, do they? Yeah, a lot of distraction going on there, which none of which you're having to deal with. The book is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich is the author, of course, with Rebecca Paley. We'll come back and talk more with Betty about her life and what she does not like to call personal shopping, but it is her job and has been for 38 years now at Bergdorf Goodman. Back on The Exchange with Betty and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Betty Halbreich, the legendary personal shopper from Bergdorf Goodman in New York. She's been there for 38 years now and has written a book about not just what she does at work, but all the events leading up to her life at Bergdorf Goodman. The memoir is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. You can join us here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So many people seem so interested in what you do, Betty. Is it longevity mostly, or the way in which you do your job? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I prefer to think it's the way I do it. I try to make it a bit different every day because otherwise I'd be bored out of my skull. You know, just holding up a dress, putting something on, a dress or a suit or something, talking somebody into buying something, that's utter boredom to me. I mean, there is another life outside of this job, which thank goodness I've managed to do. I mean, I love the theater. I love to read. I don't ever go into another store when I'm not working. I don't think I've been in another store in years. Once the door closes on me and I've clocked out, I'm gone into another world. You have to understand, I was born in Chicago. I came to New York in 1947, right after World War II. It was a whole new world opening up in this city. I've never forgotten my roots in Chicago. I was just there last week. The city looks good, smells good to me. I went to camp in Wisconsin. I went to college in Colorado. I went to another camp in Montana. I have very fond memories of things outside of New York. I've never felt like a New Yorker. So I've sort of brought that to the workplace and given them a little different thrust that I find, and I love my New York friends, and I really am a New Yorker, I guess. Sometimes I find them a bit insular. And I always, when I moved here, I said, you all go across the water to Europe, but you never go across your own country. So I'm a big believer in sort of embracing all parts of this country, and I try to bring that to the table. I think some people think I'm perfectly cuckoo, and I don't care. I really prefer to them to think I'm a bit cuckoo. I'd like to be a bit eccentric. I'm a one-liner person. I probably killed more sales. It's amazing. They don't come near me. You don't ask me, Jeffrey, about my boss. I haven't seen my boss in maybe a month, unless I pass him in the elevator. I have to tell you a cute story. There are many people, including the manager of the store, that sometimes when they see me coming, they flee for the quickest escalator or elevator. So that kind of tells you who I am in a strange way.
You got some protected status there then, don't you?
What?
You have some protected status there then, don't you?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I keep trying to reinvent myself. I've never had to look for a job, ever. It's all been brought to me. And I say yes, and then I'm taken into a situation and don't really know what to do with it. I wrote another little book, Fashions of a Therapist, 1998. Someone asked me to do that. This book, someone said, why don't you? So I've been fortunate that way. In my own personal life, I think that encompassed so much for so many years of my life that I was wallowing in it. Mm-hmm. And you know that's called self-pity. And that's why I wrote this book with Rebecca. I really wrote it on a legal pad every weekend, and it was something I had to get out when I started. And I had to protect my children. I have grown children, as you know, mm-hmm. probably as well.
John and Kathy, yeah.
Yep. Kathy, who is an associate director of MoMA here, and John, who has his own business. They're adult children with adult children. So there was a fine line of how far I could go. And I will say to you, when I gave the children the book, the children, they're still my children. I'll be 100 and they'll be in their 70s, and they're still my children. But I waited for some sort of a response. My daughter said to me, I hear your voice, Mom. My son said to me, I finished it.
That's all he said?
Yeah, that's all. And I can't get any more out of them. And I suspect I don't even want to.
Yeah, that could lead to some interesting discussions based on some of the history you've had. The book is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich is its author and our guest on The Exchange. Let's go way back in time. You mentioned your father and growing up in Chicago. And so he essentially was your introduction to the clothing business, or at least to the store business, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was a mighty mouse in his day. He was head of a department store, two department stores in Chicago. He was an innovator. He was a workaholic. And I often said to my mother, everybody else is going on vacation. It's the summer. Mommies and daddies take their children away. Well, your father's too busy working. He also drove too fast, and many nights, in my pajamas as a little girl, we'd get in the car. My mother would have to go get him out of jail, because he probably was hitting a policeman or doing something horrible. He was a feisty New Yorker. He was my stepfather, but I called him my father. So that was a whole part of the book that was, it was difficult to write, and unusual.
Uh-huh,
I grew up with two fathers, and scary.
Your mom, you write that you completely adored her, but I didn't have that much of her.
Well, she was always, they were out and about a great deal. Remember that we were coming out of a depression at that time. And I lived in a society of, all I remember is my mother and father dressing up and going to dinner parties or having dinner parties at our house where I would sit in the kitchen with the help and drink the dregs of what they left. I don't know. I think I was 9 years old and tasted scotch for the first time, hated it. And I always had a very big ear for a little girl. You know, little pitchers have big ears.
Mm-hmm.
And I would listen to all that conversation. They were out and about a great deal. My father traveled a lot, came to New York. My mother came to New York. I was left with household help a lot. It was lonely. Being an only child at that time, I think, was very lonely. It isn't as it is today where you have a computer, you have television. I grew up with a radio. That was my friend, and my grandfather was in the radio business. So we had many radios. It was, looking back, it seems even worse.
Worse in what respect?
Worse, I can't even go back and dig it out right now.
Well, how much were you into clothing as a kid? Because we're talking about the formation of what became your career, but I mean, how?
Oh, because I lived in my mother's closet and was always trying on her clothes. The minute she went out,
uh-huh.
I would get into that closet and try on her clothes and whatever. When I was in my teens, I could wear some of her clothes, which she did loan me. I'd try on everything, go through the drawers, straighten them up. My mother always said if the children wore their clothes one way, I always found another way to wear it backwards or forwards. I never conformed. I'm not a conformist. And I still walk to my own drummer. Today I can handle it. As a child, it made me more and more frightened.
To be nonconformist like that?
Exactly.
Hmm.
You know how children are. They all walk the same street. Today maybe it's different, but I see my grandchildren. They're all sort of, they all live in different worlds, but I alone have my own mirror to face and generally a maid to talk to at night. That's where I learned to cook.
From your maid?
Yep. And I remember when I first moved to New York, calling my mother, and I was so proud of myself. I learned how to make hollandaise sauce. Cooking is one of my grand escapes. Grocery stores, I adore. That's what I do on the weekend. Everyone makes fun of me. I live alone in the same apartment I've lived in for 60 years, if you can imagine anything like that.
Wow.
In New York. And I go to every grocery store, and I can cook on Saturdays and Sundays, and I never have an empty refrigerator. And I love it. It's absolute food therapy. And there are a lot of people like me, but do they put it down on paper, you know?
Yeah, well, we're lucky to have it on paper. The book is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich, the legendary personal shopper from Bergdorf Goodman in New York, written with the help of Rebecca Paley. You can join us on The Exchange. Comments or questions are welcome at 800-838-3760 across the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. And we have an email here from Ray in Roseburg, Oregon. He says, blessings to Betty. Sounds like she's still having fun when so many people don't enjoy their work. Go for it, Betty. Keep on.
How nice is that? How old is he? He can come over anytime.
He didn't include that information in his email, darn it.
Oh, see, that's that email. You just say just what you want and then a period.
Right. You couldn't even get the sound of his voice over the phone and know how old he was. All right, so which brings up a question here, but you were into clothing a bit as a kid, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if, as you describe in the book, the next fascination, if you pretty much turned the fascination with clothing into a fascination with boys.
Oh, dear. You really want to know all that? Would you believe I went back to Chicago this past week to the Arts Club, and a luncheon. An old friend of mine that I went to camp with got together. Three men. One was a young man at that time. We were in second grade together.
Wow.
The second one was the son of my mother's best friend. She had gone to kindergarten with his father. I went to Sunday school with him. The third one was a man. He said to me, I took you out. You really didn't like me, and I kept calling you, and you kept hiding. I said, but you came to take a look at me anyway. Now, that's three men who are all in their 80s, which I thought was sort of dear. One, whom I talk about in the book, who my father called a couch potato, because Danny was there morning, noon, and night. Every time my father came home, he was sitting there. When my father left, he was still there. And he just died 3 weeks ago, and I just heard about it when I was in Chicago.
No, I'm sorry.
So it's, yes, I've always liked men, a lot.
So where did you meet Sonny Hallbreich?
Oh, my God. I met him in Florida. My mother had taken me away from Chicago because I was sick of the boy next door, and the boy next door was not sick of me, and he was making a nuisance out of himself. So my father packed us up, sent us to Florida, where his uncle and aunt were living for the winter, when, like older people did at that time. And the hotel they were living in happened to belong to Sonny Halbreich's father. And I was sitting, sunning myself, when a bellboy came over and said, the owner's son would like to meet you. And that's how it started.
How did he and your dad get along?
Adored each other. They were only 15 years difference in their age.
Ah.
Which is a very unique thing, a father-in-law and a son-in-law, to only be 15 years difference in age. They could have been brothers.
Right.
When my father died, the marriage fell completely apart because he didn't bolster it up. He wasn't there to bolster it, and that's when the hard times came. A lot of it was my fault. I admit it. You know, I'm free to admit it.
You were scared of living in New York City, you write in the book.
Always. Still have some fears of it. It was very frightening to me. I didn't have any friends. I didn't have my mother and father. I lived a very insular life. Incidentally, I didn't raise my children that way. When they were little people, I put them on the subway alone and sent them downtown, uptown to Brooklyn and whatever.
I saw that, 9 years old, and John missed his stop and ended up in the Bronx.
He didn't make the right stop. Or I sent them on the bus. All the things that I was afraid of, I made them so independent that they rarely call home.
Huh. So the whole call your mother thing, really.
Call your mother.
Right. Mm-hmm. Betty Hallbreich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. It sounds like, though, with Sonny Hallbreich, that this is a very fancy and exciting life, certainly after his working hours.
Yes. Well, we went out a lot. But people did at that time. We dressed. I mean, we got dressed, and we dressed for each other. We dressed for friends. And you had to have something new to wear. El Morocco and the Copacabana and the Versailles, and we stayed out all on weekends, and then we had large parties, dinner parties, and the men played cards. There was a card night where the women sat in the living room and the men sat in another room and played cards. Yes, it was a very, very nice life. We never divorced, which is the unique thing that most people don't understand.
Really? You're just separated?
We never divorced. Huh. He lived with another woman, and I had a friend whom I really, a really good man friend who died 7 years ago, and we lived our separate lives, but we never divorced. We never got around to it.
Huh. Sonny, it sounds like, was a real lavish spender for a night out, but what was it like trying to, you know, furnish an apartment with him and stuff like that?
Oh, it was very lavish. His father was a gambler, and I don't know if you know any gambler mentalities. Scary. Sonny was conservative. His father was a racetrack guy. He played Chemin de Fer, Las Vegas. My sister-in-law married a man that owned a hotel in Las Vegas that was right up their alley. The father and son, I so many times tried to get Sonny to leave New York. I would have lived anywhere with him to get him out of this environment. It just wasn't an environment I enjoyed, and I was never comfortable in it. That's the light part of the story.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like when things got bad between you and Sonny that you two were pushing a lot of each other's buttons.
Yes, yes. And I was defying it. And that's where the spoiled child in me came out. You know, only children have some sort of a, I don't know if the word is spoiled, but it is something that is very difficult to get across to people. And then I would retract into my own sort of sad world. And I was not an angel. I've never professed to be an angel. How boring.
I was about to say, life would not be as much fun if you had been an angel, right?
You know, nobody's ever accused me of being boring, Jeffrey.
No, they haven't. So it was not a preordained thing that you were ever going to work, certainly not as somebody who came to New York in 1947. It wasn't really expected of women at that time. I mean, what was your thought about working from early on in your life?
I never thought about it, and as I've explained to people every time, these jobs all came up at cocktail parties where I'd meet someone, and they'd say, I think you'd be great. Why don't you come and work for me? And I, in my stupidity, because I have always had to be pushed along to do something, always. That was my mentality. I wasn't a self-starter.
Huh. But lots of people gave you opportunities and you took them up on it.
They certainly did. They saw something in me I could not face myself.
The book is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Betty and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange for a final segment in a minute 25. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Betty Halbreich, the longtime personal shopper head of the Solutions Department. She does not like the term solutions or personal shopper at Bergdorf Goodman in New York. She's written about her life and her work in a book called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Yours, Betty, we were just talking about your work history and how people just said, hey, we think you'd be good at this, and you'd take them up on it, and away you'd go. But in the process of your marriage to Sonny Halbreich coming to an end and getting into the world of work, you do describe something that it reads like a suicide attempt.
Mm-hmm.
But as you point out, it wasn't necessarily the end of your life you were seeking.
No. I just wanted to... I think I probably thought that would bring him back. And it was a foolish thing. Actually, it turned out to be one of the best things of my life. Because entering an institution takes a lot of courage, unless you're brought in on a gurney.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew full well what I was doing. And the help I was getting outside obviously was not the right help. because you have to, that's a pretty desperate move, you know, to take a knife and say, I'm going to slip my wrists and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew what I was doing, but I wasn't functioning correctly. So I ended up in what was called Payne Whitney at the time. And lo and behold, they kept me for over 6 weeks. I mean, you are incarcerated.
Mm.
And I used to look out of the windows that didn't open and the bars on them and see the people that I saw my own children coming up the walk, laughing away, coming to visit me. I saw Sonny coming to visit me and seeing six medical people in a row sitting there and ask him what my chances were to get back to this whole thing, the marriage, and he said it was 99% over. That was the killer.
Hmm.
And that was the finality of the whole thing, and I knew that when I came out of that institution, I had to come out somewhat of a whole person. I mean, I walked out of that institution with a pillow under my arm and a suitcase with clothes in them to go home to an apartment that I had lived with him in, with my dog going blind and deaf, which killed me when I walked in, a woman that had lived with me for almost 30 years, and that was probably the most dreadful part of my life. Because that was just going to the bottom of the well and pulling yourself back up again. That's not to say that a lot of people don't have this and haven't suffered from it. I just was too frail.
Mm-hmm. It really was the bottom. And then
it was the bottom. I mean, I was scraping bottom. I really didn't care what happened to me. But I have always had people behind me, friends, acquaintances, that see something in me that I don't see in myself, which is kind of good.
It is. I mean, they're willing
to say.
You know,
that's kind of nice. I don't face that mirror in the morning. I sometimes face the mirror in the morning and say, good morning, mother, because now I think I've turned into my own mother.
I do the same thing.
Is that
how'd
the
her
most
face
frightening
get in the mirror?
Thing?
Yes.
I say to myself, oh, dear God, not only are you starting to look like her, you sound like her.
So how did Bergdorf Goodman come about? Was this another thing that happened out of a cocktail party or something?
Coming here?
Bergdorf Goodman, yeah.
Yes. There was a complete takeover of this store at one time. New people had bought it, and a new regime was coming in, and a young woman I knew only casually happened to move across the street from me. She had moved from California to New York with her husband, and she was made executive vice president. And she said, come to Bergdorf's. I said, I can't come to Bergdorf Goodman. I don't know how to add. I've been in a mental institution. I weigh 98 pounds. She said, we'll find something for you. She had an oriental attitude, some sort of a faith attitude that I've never met since. She since passed away and was much younger than I. And she made me come to be interviewed here, and all the powers that be interviewed me, and everyone said the same thing. Oh, you're lovely, but what'll we do with you? And I just sat and stared at them. It seems they were building a Jeffrey Bean department, and they put me downstairs on the second floor in the most beautiful little department, facing the park. Beautiful windows, and Mr. Bean used to come in and redecorate that department weekly. And I had worked for him, which is in the book. So that's where they put me for about a year and a half, and I gave all my sales away because, as I have reiterated, I do not use a cash register.
So you didn't even write down the sales you were making?
Nope. I gave it away to all the ladies that had been there. Some had been here 20 years. 25 years. I was scared to death of them, Jeffrey. I mean, I was like a child compared to these women. They were hard-nosed sales ladies. I knew then I was never going to be like they.
Hadn't your mother once warned you not to take a job taking clothes on and off people?
She said, if you have to go, my father never allowed me to work as a young woman. And my mother said to me, the one thing you must never do never go to work in a store, never take clothes on and off of people. That was degrading. Well, 37 years later, here I am.
So you talked about not liking working as a commission salesperson, not writing stuff down. And at some point, your boss at Bergdorf confronted you, right?
My boss? Oh.
About not writing things down?
And, my goodness. No, he said, we have no record of your sales. I'd been here a year and a half. I don't think they knew what I was doing. Like, they thought maybe I was walking around all day. I was puttering around in Mr. Bean's department, offering up all kinds of advice to people who walked in and then passing them on to the sales force. Anything to get out of going and learning how to use that cash register.
So, essentially, your boss at the time said, what are we going to do with you?
Yes, and I said to him, give me a small personal shopping office. I think I know what we need here. We didn't have it at the store. We had two very prestigious women helping only the very carriage trade. We didn't have, you could walk in, make an appointment. If you needed an evening dress or you needed a wedding dress, there was no personal service here. It was a very, carriage trade store at that time. It's all different today, may I tell you.
Sure. So there was a trial run first, and then who's the first woman who walked in as a customer for this new service, this new personal shopping service?
Well, that I don't remember. Did I write about that?
Yeah, it was Babe Paley.
Oh, no, I was tested.
Oh.
That's before I got the job. My dear people upstairs on that floor that I never go up to and still don't had me set up with her, testing me how I would sell her.
And this is the wife of...
And guess what? I passed.
Excellent. But this is the wife of William S. Paley, the head of CBS, right?
And Babe Paley.
Yeah.
And the one question I asked her, and she did laugh, I said, you know, I have to ask you something. People tell me you have the most beautiful colored hair. Do you rinse it in Tintex? Now, Jeffrey, you probably don't know what Tintex is. It's a dye you use on clothing.
So it's like Rit dye for its time?
And she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, no, it's my natural color. But something gave me the impetus to at least have some sort of personality come forward. You know, how dull can you be?
Right, but boy, what a thing to... it was a personal question even then.
Oh, yes. It just slides out. God has one slit on one side of me that the mouth keeps going in spite of itself.
You know, I had to wonder when I first saw the name Rebecca Paley, who was your co-writer on this book.
A very young woman.
Is she related at all to those Paleys?
No.
Really?
Not at all. Mm. No. And she's lovely. And she's like my child now. Mm. I mean, she laughed at all of this. We had a good time. You know, I'd write out on a legal pad. She'd restructure a little bit. But basically, I thank the Lord. It is my thinking and my writing. And whatever becomes of this book, it was a grand catharsis.
It really is cathartic. I see that, particularly when you talk about the long periods of analysis with Philip.
He's still in my life.
I was going to say, you have some really mixed feelings about that process, don't you?
Oh, not only that, we speak, and he has been calling me, and he said to me, this is the cutest part of the story of Philip. He said, look, Betty, I think there's some things we haven't touched on. I said, don't you even think about it. He said, I won't charge you anything. Just come back for a few sessions. I finished that part of my life.
How long ago?
Oh, 30.
Really? And he still wants you to come back.
Yeah. A few unfinished. Don't we all have some unfinished things? I'm taking them to my grave.
That sounds fair enough. All right. So in the work as in this personal shopping department, which somebody named Solutions, and you don't like the term personal shopper, you don't like the name Solutions either?
Do you know that nobody has fessed up to who named this department? When they named it Solutions, I thought they were talking about a drugstore. It sounded like something you went and got at the pharmacy. I have never liked it. No one has owned up to it. At this point, who cares? You know, I couldn't change it. What's the difference?
You know, it's so fun to be in your presence, obviously. I mean, do some people come in and just spend time with you?
Oh, have you got it?
And not actually buy any clothing?
Oh, it's a good thing I don't work on a commission. Absolutely. It's a do drop in. There is no question of it. And I reinvented myself just like my mother in that bookstore. Only she smoked and drank coffee.
Hmm.
It's the same thing. Yes, they passed through to go to the bus, to make a phone call, to say they'd like something, or what do you think you're doing, or what's going on. I mean, yes, it's become a salon. It's nice. I have plants growing on the window. It's like home, away from home.
You are very blunt about some of the stuff in the store. I mean, when clothing's not attractive, you are pretty clear that it's not attractive, especially shoes, I find. You're pretty hard on shoes.
Oh, I'm hard on everything.
Uh-huh.
I'm hard on everything. I'm hard on backless dresses. I'm hard on short dresses. I'm hard on prints. I mean, I'm tough when it comes to selling clothes. Look, I like longevity for the money. I don't sell a dress to be worn once, that some husband's going to call me up and say, listen, what are you doing with my wife? Now, I speak to a lot of these husbands. I know them, or keepers, or partners, or whatever you want to call them today. I don't want to be known as a lady who just gouges you and indulges something that's not right for me. So
how blunt are you, Betty, with the women who come in there if they're trying something on and you know they love it, but you're thinking,
as soon as they put one arm in it, I can tell them to take it off. It's a phenomenon that I've created, and it's so. Look, if I haven't learned something in these 37 years, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to do this, you know. This is an eye. And knowing sizing and knowing your designers, you know, you don't have to even go to college. I went to college to be a sociologist. Well, this isn't far off, is it?
I guess not. But, you know, it's really interesting the kinds of communication you get with customers, though. And I'm starting to call them clients in my mind because it's almost
like...
Well,
they are clients. Yeah. And then they're, you know, even theatrical people. As soon as women take their clothes off, they shed something, don't they? They shed some sort of identity. So there they are, standing there, rather helpless, until I put something on them. And they have to face a mirror. It's very difficult for a lot of women to do, to see themselves in the three-way mirror. I'm there to ease the pain.
And some of them say, apparently, I believe in you, and you say back, don't believe in me.
Well, I really want them to believe in me. You know, I do have some sort of mother instinct. I'm not a monster. I'm not a clothing monster. I take good care of the people that come in here, I hope. I do it with some heart, and I hope a lot of honesty.
Well, we will see if this possible development of an HBO show with Lena Dunham comes to pass about your life. The book is called I'll Drink to That, A Life in Style with a Twist. Betty Halbreich, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
And thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you so much.
All right, take care of yourself.
For listening.
Oh, absolutely. And that'll do it for The Exchange. If you'd like to find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest, go to jeffexchange.org. Find us on our Facebook page as well. We also have a Twitter feed available on the air. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Monday on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll talk about the concept of a state-sponsored retirement plan for the state of Oregon. We'll talk about the Eugene Library adopting the Imagination Library with free books for kids. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran at the controls right now. Our student assistant for the first hour, Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Welcome to As It Was, Tales from the Mythical State of Jefferson. Here's a tall tale from Curry County, recounted by Bill Wallace for the Curry Historical Society. It goes like this. Once there was a fellow known for cheating others by selling things twice that didn't belong to him, leaving two purchasers and the original owner to argue over possession. When the law caught up to him, the judge asked if he had ever engaged in honest work. He said he was a woodcutter by trade. The judge sentenced the man to 1 year in jail, but offered to release him early if he would saw a load of wood into blocks, split the blocks, and stack them inside the courthouse. Working from dawn to dusk, the man soon had the wood stacked in the courthouse. The judge kept his word, called the man to court, and expressed his and the sheriff's satisfaction. They all shook hands, and the woodcutter left town the next day. That September, when the janitor started up the wood furnace, he couldn't get the split wood into the firebox. The cheater had been up to his old tricks, cutting each block exactly 2 inches too long for the furnace. Today's episode of As It was written by Kernan Turner and produced by Raymond Scully. I'm Shirley Patton. As It Was is a co-production of JPR and the Southern Oregon Historical Society. To share stories or to learn more about the series, visit asitwas.org.